So this is a nod to my early upbringing. I bet most of the students don't know who this is, but some of the older folks might. Men Without Hats is a group from the, I guess, late 70s, early 80s. And they may have been a nascent inspiration for my career. I never actually understood what the group's logo meant until I was trying to figure out how I would talk today. But I'm pretty sure they were talking about this rebellion, this idea that people would wear a hat that identified themselves, and that was their career. This person might be a butler. If you wear a fire hat, you are a fireman. And so a chef's hat means you are a chef. And so the idea is if you aren't wearing a hat, you can do more things. You can do anything that you want to without this sort of canalization. And to me, that's a pretty important idea in terms of the work that I like to do and want to do. And I thought that would be something worthwhile to talk about in front of students, because at a time when you're working so hard to get a degree to earn your hat, you may in the end not want to put that on. So we can talk a little bit about that. But the idea that I was asked to talk about was interdisciplinarity. And I wasn't entirely sure what that meant when I was asked to speak about it, but I agreed and then figured I'd look it up later. And some people might ask, is this interdisciplinarity? It's a beach, you can have fun, sunbathe, and you can collect moths, which my friend Dr. Mandy Heddle is doing here. But no, this is actually just multitasking, and that's slightly different. In fact, to figure out what interdisciplinary actually meant, I went to the definitive source for everything, and that is Wikipedia. And this is really the definition that they gave. I think the important parts of that might be this idea of integrating two or more academic disciplines. And the idea that to do this, or the reasons, the motivation behind interdisciplinary work, is that these problems may be too complex for a single discipline. And that's really what I think about, is this idea of trying to integrate strengths that I might have and colleagues might have into a more synergistic and effective research product. And so this is a very rare picture. I think very few will appreciate how rare this is. This is Dr. Jerry Powell, who's sort of a curmudgeon at Berkeley, and he's wearing a skater cap. And I don't know if he was drunk when this was taken or what, but it was so rare that I really wanted to put it up here. And he represents maybe one of my earliest inspirations for interdisciplinary research, because he's a very firm, hardcore, classic systeminist. He describes new species. But he also dabbles on the side, almost in secret, in conservation, and he'll work on agriculture and forest problems, but he won't really talk about it. It's just you're discussing his research with him, and suddenly he's talking about conservation biology, but he would never admit to being a conservation biologist. And I think that's a good inspiration, but maybe it's okay to take it a step further. And so for me, I would say that I readily admit to doing projects which are fully ecological or fully interested, or their motivation is solely conservation biology, and other ones where systematics might be the motivation. But in a different setting, I might be the morphologist, or I'm the one who's doing the molecular work, or on and on. Sometimes you might think of interdisciplinary as being different orders of insects. I was trained as a lepidopterist, but I supervise and collaborate with students who are working on Hemiptera, which has no direct relevance, or Diptera, which is another order completely. So how you want to define this interdisciplinarity really depends on the scale of the question and the context of the question. So be open to that, I guess I would suggest. And more practically speaking, in entomology, I think a lot of cliches come up. When I wanted to do a broad range of work, one of the people giving me advice says, you can't be a jack of all trades, but a master of none. And I think, well, that's true, but who says you have to be the master? As long as you can make a contribution, you can be a cog in the wheel. And again, that's another cliche, but it's not so bad to be a contributor. You don't have to necessarily direct the project. And if you free yourself of that and you're willing to just contribute what you can and find other people who can do the other parts, I think the amount of work and the range of work that you can participate in increases dramatically. But the trick there is that you really have to have a vision and a familiarity that's broad enough to understand what your role in the project is going to be. And that takes time and an interest in reading and dabbling in other fields. So that can be good, but the final point of that might be that not all players are going to be valuable. You might want to work with people, but it might not be an appropriate situation. And so that's something to keep in mind, too. I won't give you an example of that today, but I will give you some examples of collaborations that have worked and are working for me, because I hope that they might give you some ideas of things that you can do, and no ideas of what you can't do. The nice thing about interdisciplinary work is you get a synergistic acceleration. You do what you can, you contribute your part, your collaborator contributes something you couldn't, and it comes back to you and inspires you to do even more. And so it takes the research farther than it would have if you'd done it alone or they'd done it alone. It also tends to be a lot more fun. When it doesn't, when you have, you can end up with sort of miscommunications and frustrations that'll make you want to hide behind your scope, which as a systematist means not work with anybody else for extended periods because the work isn't getting done, you're not communicating effectively. So that's a challenge when you're doing interdisciplinary work, when you're collaborating with other folks. So if you want to be doing something that's interdisciplinary, I found that if it's too focused in a single field, it really isn't interdisciplinary, and that's something you have to recognize too. You can't make something interdisciplinary if it really isn't, and in that case you probably need to shoulder it yourself and take the project forward. I've done that a couple of times and realized that there are limitations to what you can do and can't do, and finally, one of the main things is you have to leave your ego at the lab bench, and this is challenging for everybody because we all invest in a project and you want to see it through and you want to see your part of it be the most prominent part of it. It's natural, it's human nature, but the reality is it can't usually be that way. And so you have to take that apart and remember that this is science. What's going to do best for the project is really the best way to pursue it. That sounds a little bit trite, but when you're actually practicing interdisciplinary research with collaborators, I think it becomes the most important part of what I might say today. And finally, the motivation. Before I get into some examples of what interdisciplinary work has meant to me, the motivation can be this legitimacy. Because if you have different specialists who represent different specialties, then when the product comes out, the different fields that might criticize it, oh, you didn't have an ecologist there, you don't know what you're talking about, or more frequently as a systematist, I look at a project that should have had a systematist on it and didn't, and think of all the things they did wrong. And if you can get different people in there, it may not come out perfect, but at least your perspective is going to be broader and you're going to have a better coverage of issues that might not otherwise be recognized by the people who are in there. So things that are going to be controversial, projects that are going to have results that somebody is going to be happy with, those often are the best ones to address in an interdisciplinary way with collaborators. And I'll give you some examples that might make that clearer. One of them involves one of my students who's sitting in the back of the room, but there's a situation where we have bad infestations of fruit flies in Hawaii, tifritid fruit flies, that are knocking out crops, and so there's a lot of pressure to control them. The problem is that native Drosophila, which are what we call fruit flies, but in fact not fruit flies, they're yeast flies, they have an incredible radiation in Hawaii. It's famous in evolutionary circles and very near and dear to most systematists. There are perhaps even 1,000 species of endemic Drosophila in Hawaii, far more than the rest of the world. They have been found in traps that were meant to control these introduced pest fruit flies. So there's a lot of restriction on the kind of control that can be done for pest fruit flies for fear of impacting the native fruit flies. So in this case, you have conservation biologists pitted against agriculturalists. Agriculturalists are seeing their profit margins decline because of a pest. Conservation biologists are seeing the loss of an irreplaceable natural resource. How do you resolve that kind of situation? Well, what we did was get together three different people with different expertise, and this is just an example of some of what Luke was doing, some of the traps, but the players in this case are going to be more important to you. And you'll find when I'm talking about my research projects, if you really want to know about the research, you need to go to the talks, but today I'm really going to focus on the people and how that works. In this case, we had somebody from USDA ARS, Roger Vargas, who represents the agriculturalist side very strongly. That's his responsibility, is to respond to their needs. Luc Leblanc is a junior researcher. He's an international fruit fly expert, so he's very strong in the ecology and the control of fruit flies, and he's also an excellent taxonomist. And I'm not going to put my picture up there, but my motivation is going to be from the conservation biology angle. When we get together and do a project together, we're able to cover the different angles effectively, and so the research product that we can produce from this is less likely to be criticized by the agriculturalists as being too focused on conservation biology, and also by the conservation biologists as too focused on the agricultural commodity. In fact, we can, if we all hold to our own fields, but also collaborate effectively, effectively represent the results in a way that everybody can use them. And what that means here is that we can all stand behind results that say that these attractants they were using to kill Tephritids don't capture native insects when they're used appropriately, that is, in the orchards and the backyards, and that previous records which said that native things like Drosophila are being attracted to these fruit fly attractants were in fact false, but that these fruit flies, the native ones, were coming to the decaying bodies of the other insects. Isn't that disgusting, but true? So for us, it means that there is a way to manage this that that corresponds to conservation needs and agriculturalists' needs, and by presenting this research together and doing it together, we can effectively address the concerns of different stakeholders, even in the scientific fields. And that's the idea really behind, I think, doing interdisciplinary research is robustness and legitimacy, establishing those things through our mutual and different experience. And again, in this case, these are the different things that we all represented, and in the end, we're able to get something out that otherwise will inevitably make somebody unhappy. In fact, our results will still make somebody unhappy. Conservationists are gonna, some of them will think that I may not have represented that aspect of the study effectively. Agriculturalists are gonna think they should be able to eliminate fruit flies in native forest without any problem. But what we found is that there has to be some kind of compromise. Where these fruit traps are set up is gonna affect how much they impact the native insects. But we can find a way to do both things. It's just gonna require compromise. And again, we can all stand beside, you know, Roger, Luke, and I can stand together and say, these are the results, this is what we found, this is what you need to do. And hopefully, by doing that, serve most of the needs of the constituents or the interest groups for that project. Now I'm gonna talk about, a little bit about the rest of my students. This is my best student right here, supervising my other students doing some interdisciplinary work. They're not actually geologists. They're helping me with a moth project. So none of them work on the moth that they're looking for right there, but they're interested. They're learning about those things. This is Cynthia's work. You probably heard it yesterday. The idea here, again, has to do with agriculture and conservation. And I find working in Hawaii those are the most common fields that I'm working with in an interdisciplinary manner. That is, effectively trying to address two different fields, two different perspectives to come to some synthetic research product. And what we looked at there, just briefly, was this idea that native moths in Hawaii were exterminated as the result of non-target impacts from introduced biological control agents. Essentially, folks that were having trouble with moths eating crops that were desirable, like sugarcane and coconut, they brought in parasitoid wasps from elsewhere, which, in addition to eating those pesty moths, spread onto native moths, which were of conservation concern, and are now, or at least up until recently, many of them were considered extinct. So the idea behind our work was to really evaluate, did this actually happen? Are these wild Omiotes, and here's some pictures of some of them down there, and of course, there's Meteorus, one of the nasty introduced parasitoids. Are these introduced parasitoids actually killing off native moths? And so we used collected wild Omiotes and looked at their parasitism rates. We also looked at parasitism rates on Omiotes eggs, two of the things that were supposed to be completely wiped out in some cases by these introduced parasitoids. And in fact, it really depended on the species as to how high or how significant the impact of these introduced parasitoids was. And that in many cases, we had very, very low rates of parasitism on these native moths. So in this case, we were able to tease apart the idea that native moths were killed off by introduced parasitoids into what we think is a much more nuanced but accurate perspective. And that is that these early claims by opponents of biological control were probably very exaggerated. The impacts are not nearly as high as we thought. And that many native species of Omiotes, some of which were rediscovered during the course of our work, that is species which were thought to be extinct, we now realize can be fairly common in the right situations, are not going extinct and are persisting despite high parasitism rates. So even in ones which have high parasitism rates, it doesn't seem to be high enough to knock them off. So this leads to more effective questions in terms of conservation. And again, that's the motivation there, is in the end, really, in science, we're after the truth. So if we can get past what different people's interests are, conservation biologists should not be interested in debunking biological control any more than biological control folks should be interested in introducing biological control agents that are ill-considered. The point being, in the end, if we get beyond that and can realize that, in fact, native moths are not being negatively impacted, perhaps as severely as we thought by biological control agents, we can start doing the real research and addressing the real question, which is, what is the reason for the declines we've seen in these taxa that are gone? And if we start doing that, we can actually start to do real conservation. So that can be an important part of doing interdisciplinary work, is getting to what might be a very important truth behind assumptions that are held in independent fields. So again, the idea here is that maybe it's ants, maybe it's something else, but let's step beyond biological control agents and start asking other questions to test this phenomena and figure out what's going on, because again, in Hawaii, the situation is pretty severe and we're losing a lot of native species. So that would be an example of successful interdisciplinary work. Another one that's perhaps more dramatic in some ways, because it encompasses, as far as I can tell, just about every field, has to do with this little creature, which some of you again may have heard about, the Vecchio bug. This is one of the only, there's another one on the Mauna Loa volcano, but this is on the Mauna Kea volcano. These are the only two predatory ligid bugs in the world. They occur above 11,000 feet on two volcanoes on the Big Island of Hawaii and nowhere else. These volcanoes regularly in their habitat, it drops below freezing year round. So Hawaii may be balmy, but not up there. And this is what it can look like when you get a snowfall, even this time of year, no problem. And those are astronomy telescopes, because this is one of the best places to conduct astronomical research in the world. So you have a conflict there between astronomy and in this case conservation, because this is one of the only, this is the only habitat for a very, very special insect. So I got up there and it's a really harsh environment. There is no plant growth. It's too high, it's too cold, it's miserable, the sun beats down on you, you've got a tropical sun at 13,000 feet or 10,000 feet or 11,000 feet, it burns you. And I thought, this is the perfect place for a graduate student. And so Jesse's up there of his own volition, more or less, and you can see the telescopes in the background doing this work. And some of the questions that he was after are, one of them was, is this species on the Mauna Kea volcano the same as the one on the Mauna Loa volcano? And what that had never been considered previously, but what that would suggest is that the conservation units that we're working with are much bigger than we previously realized. And also, if there's genetic continuity between these different populations, it means that maybe these bugs aren't quite as vulnerable to local habitat perturbation as we had originally thought. And Jesse was able to show in some initial work that they are in fact identical across both volcanoes, which is shocking because these bugs are flightless and there's many miles of unsuitable habitat between them. So in this case, Jesse's working on the ecology of the bug, the natural history of the bug, the population genetics of the bug, and ultimately all of this is going to compile into a conservation plan for an insect in a very special place where astronomy is going to go on hand in hand with this conservation of a native insect. So there's as much incorporation of different disciplines in this project as I can really imagine readily, except for agriculture, and you can see there's no reason to do that there. And finally, I want to go into a little bit more detail about a project involving gall wasps, which is probably the most profound experience in interdisciplinary research that I've ever done. And Dr. Mark Wright is actually here, and he'll be speaking about the project in detail later on in another symposium, which you shouldn't go to. But really, this is a conglomeration of many different people and many different projects, or many different fields into one project. Because the gall wasp, and again, he'll talk about the details of it, this is an introduced tiny wasp that has effectively eliminated one of the most important dry forest trees in Hawaii, Erythrina sandwichensis, the willy willy tree in Hawaii. And I'll show you a picture of it. This nasty little beast, hardly the size of a pinhead, infests the leaves of native and introduced Erythrina trees and has effectively eliminated the tree completely from Hawaii. And in fact, it's swept across to Hawaii from somewhere where we're not entirely sure, but we think it was probably Africa. And these are the facts. It spread first to Mauritius, which is in the western Indian Ocean, about several years ago now, 2003. But it made it to Hawaii very, very quickly because it spread, if you can picture this, an insect the size of a pinhead spreading from Mauritius, just north of Madagascar, across the Indian Ocean to India, then into the Pacific Ocean, hitting the Philippines, Okinawa, Samoa, Singapore, Taiwan, and Hawaii, and now, in fact, there are records of it in Florida. That's a stunning accomplishment for just about any sort of organism, but one the size of a pinhead, it's really tremendous. And to do this kind of transportation, self-dispersal perhaps, in 3 years is really unprecedented. And if you think about it, in my opinion, and you may argue with this later, I think it's spreading much more like a pathogen than an insect. And later on, I'd like to see if we can't use some pathogen models to sort of match the spread that we're seeing with this insect and see if it matches more like a pathogen would than we see traditionally with a lot of insect pests in continental systems. And this, again, this pest is completely destroying old trees of almost all species of Erythrina. And Erythrina is a Gondwanan distribution. So there are many, many species of Erythrina in South America. They also occur across Africa and in the Pacific Rim area. So this is a very important genus of tree. But these gall wasps are somewhere out of the blue. And we think that they're coming from Africa, but we really don't know anything about them. And in fact, when we went into the broader community, we found that no one else knows anything about them either. So this is a little bit problematic when you're trying to control a pest in as quick a way as you can. So what do we do to control it? The first thing we need to know is what is it, how many species, what kind of genotypes are there, that is, what kind of genetic diversity, and where did it come from? And with that information, we can then sort of look at natural enemies and then perhaps try to understand how this thing spread so quickly. And is this something unique, or are there related wasps that could do the similar things, not just to Hawaii, but anywhere in the world? And again, this has become a global problem that really hasn't touched the United States, but the entire Pacific Basin and Indian Ocean basins are very concerned with this insect. And again, it makes things like the Asian longhorn borer, the emerald ash borer, look like molasses in the freezer. These things are still spreading. The gall wasp's already done spreading. It's everywhere in Hawaii and many other places where it could occur. I'm sure it's going to continue perhaps into South America, but that could get pretty nasty. So our job was really to survey for these wasps and the predators across Erythrina and sub-Saharan Africa, because we'd had reports that there were wasps in those areas, and to sequence the DNA of wasps from those areas. But also, we're trying to look at places where we can find biological control agents. So this is a marriage of systematics with biological control for essentially conservation purposes, although some would say for agricultural purposes, because many of these Erythrina are ornamentals. And this is just briefly a review of where we went during this trip. And now I'm going to get more into, and again, some more detail on that. I'm going to get more into the dynamics that I think are important and relevant. Collaborations can be hard because interdisciplinary work not only lends itself to collaboration, but in a case like this, requires it. But your pace is going to be a little bit slower than you might have anticipated. You're ready to race along, and in fact, it's kind of like hitting a golf or an ox cart from behind. It's going to take time, and people are going to have different ideas about where you should go. And sometimes your collaborators, here's Russ Messing, can be subject to mood swings at the turn of a leaf, and that can be hard. Mark was also an interesting person to work with, but prone to bouts of melancholy, which reminded me that you really have to be open-minded and aware that people will have different cultures within the same field, so that this can make work a little bit difficult. It can make the discussions very interesting when you're coming from a conservation perspective and other folks are coming from a strong biological control perspective. But together, ultimately, even though some of you have weird customs, some things are wrong, as this woman is clearly indicating. But the point is the same. We're going after the same goal, that is to control these gall wasps. And our perspectives are going to be different, but as long as your goal is the same, I think you can productively contribute to the same idea. And this is some of the work we were doing, trying to find them. See, everybody contributes. Mark's pointing out the tree for us there. And again, together we're working in different environments. And in the end, we were able to survey populations from many places, more than I would have been able to do alone, more than they would have been able to do alone, with my perspective as a systemist and their perspective as a biological control specialist. were able to get the kind of sampling that was relevant not only for my work as a systeminist, but for theirs in ecology. And with the assistance of Alex Shibata, we were able to put wasps in one side, get DNA out the other, and come out with a very interesting solution that is at the same time horrifying. It turns out that despite doing literally hundreds of samples across most of sub-Saharan Africa, we were unable to locate the exact population that has infested not only Hawaii, but the entire Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean basins. I cannot explain this answer to you. It's not a happy ending, but it does suggest that we have further to go in this project, and that really, these are the kinds of questions we're going to be dealing with in the future. This is one haplotype of one species that is literally spread across half the globe, and we still can't find out where it came from. Even though we've sampled, as you saw, hundreds of samples from a wide range of the continent, which we're pretty sure it came from. We're going to have future issues like this, and the idea of collaborating together to successfully accomplish the goals is the only way I can see this happening. We think we know where the region of origin is, but again, there's so much variation that it's not going to be possible to determine this in any quick fashion. So collaboration is really the only way we're going to be able to do this. And I would say that ignorance is not bliss. Just because you don't have expertise in a particular field doesn't mean that it isn't going to be an important part of the work that you're going to be doing. And the only way really to save trees like this is going to be working together. And just finally, the most interesting questions are not going to be canalized. They're not going to fall into one field or another. And while collaborating is going to be tough and introduce you to weird and unusual experiences, I think the costs are going to benefit far outweigh the benefits are going to far outweigh the costs, of course. And the point is really, you don't have to be an expert in a subject to pursue interdisciplinary work, but you do have to have the knowledge and the willingness and the openness to incorporate people from different fields of science into the project that you're trying to get to. So thank you very much for your attention, and I'll take any questions if we have time. That's a great question. Again, I had to cut some of that short in detail, but the trade winds blow up from the tropical zone and capture tropical insects that literally get too cold to fly, become moribund, and drop onto the snow banks or into the rocks up at the high elevation. So they're constantly fed. Frank Howarth claims that it's one of the only true aeolian systems in the world. That is, it's wind-driven, but there is almost no production at that zone. That's questionable. One of the things that... They have in the past been much harder to find, but we're finding with constant research and a bit of focus that we're able to find them in more places than had previously been understood. And by we, I mean not just Jesse and I, but the Bishop Museum has a whole team of people working on this too. So together we're doing survey work. They're doing a lot more broad survey work, and we're doing more intensive survey work. We're finding that the populations may be larger than we had thought in recent history. But they were actually much more common in the past. Astronomy construction was thought to have eliminated them from some of the places they used to be. We're finding that maybe they're sensitive, but not that sensitive. We haven't, but that would be another great interdisciplinary thing to do. Absolutely, it would be great.
Obviously, you can basically hitchhike a single mitochondrial haplotype through.
Right, but would it still remain virtually unfindable in its original range?